WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Holiday time is synonymous with food, and much of that food is laden with sugar. Most of us allow ourselves an indulgence or two because of the spirit of the holidays, but for some, those indulgences are impossible and harmful. For diabetics, avoiding sugar is a must. Holiday is also a time for baking, and many baked goods contain gluten, and those with allergies to gluten have to avoid those treats, too. But our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment, Peter Reinhardt, is coming to the rescue. For the past several years, this master baker has been working on sugar-free, gluten-free recipes for baked goods that satisfy just as traditional goodies would, with the added benefit of aiding people in their weight loss goals. It's like trifecta here. You can find these recipes in Peter's new book, The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking, and Peter is back for his monthly visit. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be here.
He's joined in our Spirit Square studio by Mark Allison, the Dean of Culinary Education at Johnson & Wales University. In addition to his work there, he's on the board of directors of the American Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. One of his sons has type 1 diabetes, but he must be in good hands because his dad is the recipient of the 2012 Father of the Year Award from the American Diabetes Association. Congratulations, I guess, eh?
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And here for the first part of the show is Dr. Michael Smith, who received his doctorate from the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, or Naturopathic Medicine, I'm going to have to learn how to say that, in Arizona, with advanced training in clinical nutrition. He practices at Carolina Natural Health Center, and he joins us by phone from Boone. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Mike.
What prompted you, Peter, to spend all the time you spent? Because you've been talking about this book off the air for a long time, and you've been doing research, and you've been playing with recipes, some of which failed miserably, others of which made the book, obviously. So what prompted you to take on this epic adventure?
A couple of things. One, my own need. I am not diabetic, and I am not gluten sensitive as far as I know, but one thing that I struggle with is being around food all the time, being around baking products. Weight is a challenge for me, controlling my weight, and sugar is omnipresent in everything. And I've known for a long, long time that we need to get sugar out of our diet as much as possible. So I had my own personal goals. I wanted to serve the gluten-free community with some new options. There have been a number of books in the last few years as gluten-free. The subject of gluten-free has tipped over into mainstream, but most of those recipes are starch-based. They use rice flour. They use tapioca starch. And so really, they don't help somebody who's trying to limit their sugar. And the larger community, because gluten-free might represent 5% of our population, but 30 to 35% of the population are dealing with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes. So this book is really aimed at trying to serve both of those communities. Mm-hmm.
Would we all benefit, Doctor, from even those of us who are not challenged with gluten allergies and do not have weight problems and don't have a problem with sugar? Would we all be better off eliminating those or reducing them in the things that we eat?
Reducing them, absolutely. And, we tend to have an overabundance of both sugar and gluten-containing foods in our diet, which is why we see the growing epidemic with diabetes and a growing epidemic with people with gluten sensitivities and gluten issues. So it is very important that we all work on reducing them.
And you kind of nodded your head, Mark Allison, when I was talking about reducing gluten and sugar in foods. And you're a chef, so what's your take on it from a foodie's point of view?
As a foodie, Mike, my philosophy is to try and eat wholesome food, pure food, that is lean proteins, fruits, vegetables, and try and cut back as much as you possibly can on sugar.
But now there's sugar in fruit. There's sugar in vegetables.
There's sugar in fruit, and I believe in eating an abundance of vegetables and reducing fruit, but fruit is still good for the nutritional value. But it's far better than eating something that is like a cookie that is just loaded with sugar. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that the title of your book, Peter, The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking, is a play on a previous book
Yeah, there is a book that did pretty well a few years ago.
Back in the 70s.
The Joy of Cooking. Fortunately, you're not allowed to...
I was thinking of The Joy of Sex, actually.
Well, some people say this is even better than that.
It lasts longer.
There are a couple of titles. And you're not allowed to, believe it or not, you're not allowed to copyright a book title.
Really?
You could have...
Oh, wow.
And in fact, I have a book out, a pizza book called American Pie. And, we were allowed to use that because the people who made the movie American Pie, don't own title rights.
Huh.
They own content rights. So there are a lot of books with duplicate titles. There's a book. There's two different versions of the Bread Bible by two different authors. Anyway, my publisher just came up with this idea of the joy of gluten-free, sugar-free baking because – I don't know. Coming up with titles is harder sometimes than coming up with recipes.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you if the recipes in this book, if all of them are both gluten-free and sugar-free, or are some? Do you have some of each and a few of both?
Actually, every recipe is sugar-free and gluten-free. Some recipes don't require sugar anyway. They don't require a replacement for sugar, but some do. And so there we needed to come up with sugar replacers or substitutes. And I have a co-author on this book named Deneen Wallace, who is both diabetic and gluten sensitive. Mm-hmm. She does not have celiac disease, which is even more severe than gluten sensitivity. But she's tried to cut gluten out of her diet. But more important for her as a diabetic is that starch flours, like rice flour and tapioca, work the same on her body as sugar does. It spikes her blood glucose levels. So she developed a method using nut flours and seed flours to replace the starch flours. So the premise of the book is built around that. And then for her, when she first approached me with her recipes, they were all sweetened. The ones that needed sweetener used Splenda or sucralose, which is the sweetener in Splenda. I was looking for some alternative to that would be more natural because while sucralose and Splenda taste a lot like sugar, we're still not sure, if it's – not everybody likes it because it's not purely natural. It's derived from sugar. And I've been a longtime advocate of stevia, and we've talked about stevia a lot on this show. So we started to work with stevia as well. And in the end, the two sweeteners that worked really well in all of our recipes, because there are other options like erythritol and things like that, but stevia in the raw or liquid stevia and Splenda are the two sweeteners that work in all the recipes that call for a substitute. In the end, we'd like to even, reduce the desire for the sweetness craving that we all have, but this is a transitional way of sweetening.
Actually, my doctor has told me that to stop drinking sweet tea at lunch and just drink water because – and I said, well, what about putting something like Truvia, which is the packaged version of stevia. And he said, well, yeah, it's not sugar, but you're not less – your body's craving the sweetness and you're giving in to it. So don't do that. From your point of view, Dr. Smith, what about that? How does the body see these artificial sweeteners? They taste sweet, but there's something different going on. They're not reacting in the body the way sugar does, correct?
Well, somewhat. And I think it's really a great point that we do need to reduce the desire for sweet. Oftentimes my patients will say, well, what else can I use? And I do recommend using stevia. I think it's a plant, it's a natural sweetener, and it is a safe one that people can use. But I don't want them to just go and use stevia on everything, just sweeten everything, because then we're not changing your habits in any way. Hmm. But reducing the use of sweeteners in general is beneficial. And, the artificial sweeteners, I do have concerns about them. These are chemical compounds that we really don't fully understand their long-term effects in our body.
Well, I was going to ask about that because aspartame, which I believe is the principal ingredient in NutraSweet, I think.
Maybe in the Equal or one of those. Yeah.
I think that aspartame is banned in soft drinks. It's banned in Canada. So Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi and all that, they have to have a different formulation for the Canadian market.
Yes.
Do we trust the Canadians? Are these things are these not sweet? Are these not safe? Truly?
Well, again, we don't fully understand those effects, but there's definitely been research on aspartame indicating that they may increase the rate of brain tumors in certain types of cancer. And NutraSweet was originally developed as a ant killer. So if you have an ant problem in your house, it actually works as well.
Really?
You don't see that in their commercials.
All right. Now, you're a naturopath, and I hope I'm saying that correct,
correctly. Yes, you're doing a great job.
And you folks take an alternative path in the treatment of ailments, and alternative medicine has been gaining a little stature here in this country over for a while. I'm told that you come Russ Greenfield approved, by the way. Dr. Greenfield's an alternative practitioner, also an MD, et cetera. What's your take on sugar, and what do you tell people who come to you who do have a sugar problem or who have a weight problem? What's your take on it?
You know, with people with diabetes and with a weight issue, it's the same thing that we're addressing. And really the goal is we need to lower the demand for insulin in the body. Because insulin is the main hormone that helps to regulate blood sugar in the bloodstream. But what it does is it takes that excess sugar out of your blood and stores it as fat. It is a fat stored hormone. So in order to lose weight and to help to better regulate your blood sugars, we need to lower the demand. The main way to lower that demand is by lowering your intake of your simple carbohydrates, which are your sugars.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is really important that we focus on and figure out, okay, where are we getting sugars in our diet? And it's amazing, you know, how often people are just consuming sugar without realizing it. There's so many hidden sugars out there. You know, if you go and order a pizza out at one of the fast food kind of pizza places, you not only is there sugar in the sauce, but there's sugar in the dough.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is it's because people want things sweet.
You're the pizza man.
Yeah.
Why would you put sugar in the dough? And I have been told that if you bite into something that you've never had before and you really like it, particularly at a restaurant, chances are you really like it because it's got sugar in it.
It's got some sugar.
You don't taste it, you don't know it, you don't expect it, but it's there.
Well, there's hidden sugar in pizza dough, even if you don't put sugar into the dough itself, because in most pizza dough formulations, there's very little sugar added, if any. In fact, we at the pizza restaurant that I'm involved with, Pure Pizza, we have a wonderful white pizza dough that has no sugar in it at all, but it does taste sweet. The reason being because white flour is essentially starch, which broken down means lots of different sugar compounds. And so you're releasing the sugars. So white flour has a higher ratio of sugar, for instance, than whole grain flour, which is why people prefer, you know, from a health standpoint, whole grain flour. So, but there's sugar hidden in it, even when you don't add sugar. And that's what it is that makes it taste good.
This must make life for diabetics extremely difficult. Were you aware of this as a chef before your son became diabetic?
And not so much before Matthew became a diabetic, but now for the last 14 years, well aware.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is a lot of processed food out there has corn syrup in or some kind of sugar added as a preservative as well as a sweetener. That's one of the things we found since we moved to America 8 years ago is how sweet all the food tastes.
Oh, I thought from your accent you were from Wilmington.
Charleston, actually. I'm from the United Kingdom, and I moved over here about 9 years ago, 8 years in Charlotte now. But that's one of the main things that we found is a lot of the food is really sweet. And I think one of the biggest problems, as well as the sugar, is the portion size. That's what we found since moving over here, especially if you go and eat in a restaurant.
Right.
You get something that could feed two people, not just one person. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. The sugar is a huge problem, but if people just cut back on the portion size of food, then we wouldn't have so many overweight people in the community.
But can you, as a diabetic, consume any sugar, or does it depend on how severe your diabetes is?
Well, I think it depends how severe your diabetes is, but it's amazing to me. When we came over, we've got a great doctor that looks after Matthew, but he went on the pump. And it was basically, okay, you're now on the pump.
Insulin pump,
and just eat what you want, as long as you're putting them carbohydrates in. And to me, that amazes me, because the more sugar you're putting into the body, the more insulin your body needs.
Right. Mark Allison is the Dean of Culinary Education at Johnson & Wales. He's with us along with Peter Reinhart, who is our chef on assignment and the author of The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking. And Dr. Michael Smith, Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine, joins us as well. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, offering accounting, tax, and financial advisory services for local businesses with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. And Northeastern University Charlotte hosting a graduate roundtable information session on December 12th for degrees in project management, sports leadership, and education. Details at northeastern.edu/Charlotte. This week, NASA felt compelled to release a statement assuring us that the end of the world is not imminent. And they did so because the Mayan calendar says that next Wednesday, it's curtains for all of us. It's over. So we're going to take a look at the Mayan calendar and why we think it says what it says that NASA says it doesn't say. And we'll do that Monday at 9. You have a whole weekend to gird your loins for that program.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the November jobs report, the fiscal cliff negotiations, and President George W. Bush weighs in on immigration. The week's top national stories, what happened and why.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We got Peter Reinhardt back with us for his monthly visit. This time he is in the hot seat. He is not just the co-host, he is the guest. The joy of gluten-free, sugar-free baking, his new book, 80 Low-Carb Recipes That Offer Solutions for Celiac Disease, Diabetes, and Weight Loss. And by the way, he'll be signing that book tomorrow at 2 at Barnes & Noble at Carolina Place Mall. Also with us, Mark Allison, Dean of Culinary Education at Johnson & Wales, who has a son who's a diabetic, and he is on the board of the American Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. And joining us by phone, Dr. Michael Smith, a doctor of naturopathic medicine at Carolina Natural Health Center. The book is about not just sugar-free, and we're going to get into some of the recipes and some of the gymnastics that you have to go through to cater to sugar-free, gluten-free diets, but it's also about gluten-free cooking. Can the disorders brought on in some people by ingesting gluten be as severe or potentially life-threatening as those brought on by sugar for those who are diabetic? Doctor?
They can, actually. There's a group of people that have a condition called celiac disease, which is a very severe reaction to gluten that can cause a whole host of reactions in the body. Everything from complete destruction of their small intestine, intestinal lining, and that can affect malabsorption of nutrients, to affecting other parts of the body, whether it's brain and mental function, nerve endings, hormone balance, things like that. And then also there's people that are gluten sensitive. They don't have celiac disease, but they have a reaction to gluten. And honestly, the line between the symptoms that are produced from celiac versus gluten sensitivity is fading. In my practice, I don't see a huge difference. And sometimes I'm not even as concerned, is it gluten sensitivity or is it celiac, because I'm seeing more of the same types of symptoms being produced. And there's a huge cross-reaction between gluten and autoimmune conditions and autoimmune diseases. And that's really my main concern, because I'm just seeing a flood more of patients showing up in my practice with autoimmune type conditions.
What do you think is going on here? Because I don't recall as a child ever knowing a friend who had, for instance, a peanut allergy. Nobody had a gluten allergy that I knew about. Everybody had, sandwiches with bread, usually Wonder Bread, at lunch, etc., and no one had a problem. What's going on with all these people all of a sudden exhibiting these serious allergy symptoms?
Yeah, honestly, what's changed is the actual ingredients. The wheat has changed. It's not the same wheat that we were eating 50 years ago. And it's changed in a number of ways. Some has changed through genetic modification. The majority of the wheat grown in this country is genetically modified. And then the other way that it's changed is in how it's manufactured. Most wheat now goes through a process of deaminization, which produces new and different proteins that have never existed before. And both of these things are causing an immunological response and reaction that is contributing to this growing rate of allergies, sensitivities, and autoimmune type conditions.
Boy, that opens the door to a topic that I didn't think we were going to get into today. But talk to me about this. You guys cook and use these flours in recipes all the time. Why do we do this if it causes this kind of reaction?
Well, this is an interesting sort of new hot button topic, because the whole issue of genetic modification in species of food sources is very touchy. large companies like Monsanto control these things for, and ostensibly the purpose is good. It's to feed this growing world population. But the intuition of people who have been opposed to it has always been, we don't know what the long-term downstream effects are going to be of messing with these foods at the genetic level. And yet it's hard to prove that. But now we're starting to see proof, and it's only been a few years out. We're starting to see proof because of the increasing resistance.
There was a story on the news this week about a new fish, a new Atlantic salmon that they've crossbred. They've genetically changed the fish so that in the first year it ends up being twice as large, three times as large as a normal Atlantic salmon, so that you can harvest it more quickly and get more product, essentially. And they asked, well, do we know what's going on here? You cross genes and you genetically modified this fish. We've been doing this since the beginning of time. We domesticated animals and we domesticated wildflowers, etc. It's never harmed anybody. It doesn't harm anybody. You're saying that's not true.
Well, we sure don't know, but we're beginning to see, as people live longer now, the effects of the changes that we make in our eating really start to show up, you know, a few years downstream.
So when the body reacts negatively to gluten, sometimes it happens later in life. It doesn't happen when you're a child. Sometimes it onsets after 50. Why, doctor?
It can really happen at any point in time. And, you know, so people can be eating it for long periods of time, and then what sometimes will show up is it's not just one thing. It's oftentimes there's an environment in your body where now you're much more sensitive or much more reactive to things, and you start to develop a sensitivity or an immune response to a food that you're eating. And this can be triggered by stressors, you know, in our daily life. It can be triggered by a virus. It can be triggered by antibiotics or some other drug use. All these things can inhibit the normal reactivity to foods that stem from our digestive tract, which is where most of our immune system is regulated from.
My understanding, doctor, maybe you can confirm if I've got this correct, is that a lot of times people will have a sensitivity, for instance, gluten. It could be celiac disease, which is genetically inherited, but that they don't realize over a long period of time that they have this because they haven't hit that health crisis wall, so to speak. But that, so they may go for 20 or 30 years before all of a sudden their body crashes from an accumulation of essentially malnutrition. And then when they hit that crisis, their sensitivity becomes hypersensitivity because something totally changes. And then after that, you know, one taste of bread or something could really send them back to the hospital. Is that realistic?
Sometimes that is true, and that does show up that way. You know, because, and the other thing too is that many people, you know, that are listening right now may have a gluten issue, gluten sensitivity, and don't realize it because they're eating it all the time. And so they're always reacting, and they don't realize, they've forgotten what good feels like.
They haven't made the connection.
Yes, exactly. I just had a patient just before we got on the air who, you know, we've identified for her that it's tomatoes and eggs and dairy. And she used to eat them all the time before. I had no idea they were affecting her. Now it's so clear to her how they affect her.
Wow. Given the fact that over the last 50 years, the nature of wheat has changed, can you still find the old wheat? And if you did find the old wheat and made flour from it, would you be able to eat normally again?
Well, there's a movement afoot right now in North Carolina, an initiative to bring back heirloom wheat that is from this area. And it's being grown, it's being harvested, and actually milled in Asheville. And there's a small supply of it. People can get that wheat. I've tasted it at the Asheville Bread Festival, which is a fun event to go to in March for those who can come. But it's sweet, it's delicious. And, yeah, we're hearing that people are having better success at being able to digest that because it is what their body actually was born to do.
And what do you know about that, doctor?
Yes, it is. It depends on the individual. Some people that are very severely sensitive to gluten may not. But I've had many patients who've traveled to Europe for vacation, and they eat bread there and feel just fine, have no reaction whatsoever, and come back to the States and eat bread, and they're reacting terribly.
And there's a lot of people who eat spelt and kamut, which are variations of wheat. They're in the wheat family, who say, hey, I can eat spelt bread, but I can't eat regular bread. And it's probably because these are grains that haven't been messed with too much by the genetics. And so they're going back to, a kind of an ancient grain.
I know that I have to let Dr. Smith go because it's time. Dr. Michael Smith, Doctor of Naturopathic Medicine with Carolina Natural Health Center here in Charlotte. Thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming into the holiday time. Everybody's baking. Everybody's cooking. Everybody's planning their holiday menus and party treats. And a lot of those, as I said, are sweet. Many of them are baked. So you got all this stuff going on here. We try to exercise, most of us, some willpower with varying levels of success. What are some of the common eating mistakes that we make during the holidays that can affect our health and how we feel?
I think one of the biggest mistakes is just overindulgence in the food that you want to eat because you've got more time off work, you've got the family coming round, so it's a big special occasion for everybody, and everybody just overindulges.
Ah, it's holiday time. I won't do it in January.
Yeah, we'll just put it back to a later date, and then we can all diet, but we know that a lot of the time diets don't work, and we need more exercise, but I think it's just overindulgence and too big a portion. But if we can reduce the amount of sugar that's in the food and the carbohydrates, then we can all stay a little bit healthier over this holiday season.
Let me get your take on corn syrup while we're at it, too, because some people think corn syrup is far worse for you than sugar. Others say it's sugar. That's all it is. It's just sugar, so there's no difference whatsoever. Unfortunately, it seems to be in everything.
It seems to be in everything that is processed because it preserves the food and gives it a longer shelf life.
Really?
So really, not only are you extending the life of a product and making it unnatural, but you're also adding all the sugar to preserve the product as well.
I love those commercials that they have, with the corn syrup commercials going, yeah, it's just sugar.
Yeah,
it's just sugar. As if that's a good thing. So even if it was just sugar, which it is chemically speaking just the sugar, but it does have, as Mark said, a function, and the functionality of syrup as opposed to crystallized sugar is that it actually holds moisture into a product. So as a result, the food industry has moved to that. It's cheaper than cane sugar, and it has this added function of shelf life. So they put more of it in there.
That's right.
And so as Dr. Smith was saying, there's so much hidden sugar in things, and the hidden sugar in many things is this corn syrup used as almost like a preservative.
When you say it's just sugar, there was a move. The FDA was thinking, I'm told, was thinking about investigating whether sugar should even be legal at one point in time.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, sugar's like heroin, isn't it? Once you get addicted to it, it's a hard track to get off. And if you look at the rise of type 2 diabetes, which is completely different to what my son has, which is type 1, Matthew's in a 5% population of type 1 diabetics. Type 2 is 95%.
And type 1 is naturally occurring, and type 2 is brought on by overconsumption of sugar?
That's right. Lack of exercise and too much sugar in your diet. And 85% of type 2 people are overweight. And if you're overweight, then the insulin that your body is producing has a hard time to bring down the sugar.
And we actually have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes.
Epidemic. It's probably the fourth largest medical condition related to death in the country, which will probably be number one very soon.
And it's not just death. I mean, it's the things that it does to your body. It's circulatory problems. People lose limbs because of it. It's not a nice thing.
It's not a nice thing long term.
Blind.
You can go blind. You can have your arms or your legs amputated. You've got to be really careful with your feet. Mm-hmm. And it's not a nice disease to have. For Matthew, who is 15 now, who's had this condition for the last 14 years, it's worrying his parents to think what his future is going to be like. And that's why we try to monitor his carbohydrates every day.
And yet there are, you know, once you know that you have the condition, you can manage the condition. I have a friend who discovered that he had juvenile diabetes in the fourth grade. He is now 62 years old and one of the leading practitioners of pediatric medicine focusing on juvenile diabetes. Huh. And he's been healthy and a great athlete all his life.
So are the recipes in this book and others like it, the gluten-free, sugar-free recipe kind of thing, healthy alternatives for those people? I mean, those people with gluten problems and those people with diabetes and sugar intolerance problems?
Exactly. And for the type 2 diabetics, which Deneen essentially found out, my co-author Deneen found out that she was diabetic at the age of 36, not from actually the normal overweight issues. She's at the perfect weight. She has no family history of it, but her pancreas just stopped producing insulin.
But
she found out that she could get off of the insulin shots that she needed by controlling her diet.
But if carbohydrates turn into sugar once they're digested, and that's part of the problem with carbohydrates, aren't there carb? I'm looking at the cover of your book, and there's this lovely cake with icing.
It's a carrot cake,
it's a carrot cake with icing and almonds on top, and it looks fabulous. Isn't that carbohydrate?
Well, most of the carbs that are found in baked products are in the flour or in the sugars that you add. And so what we've done is eliminated both of them. There's no actual flour, no starch-based flour. Instead, we use almond flour, pecan flour, walnut flour, sunflower seed flour. And those are really high in protein, high in fiber, and very, very low in carbs. So we go by something called the glycemic load index, which is how much of a spike in your blood sugar is caused by a portion of food. And most foods, especially if they have starches and sugars, will spike your blood to a 30 or 40 degree, you know, point range. Our goal was to have every portion in this book be under 5 glycemic load points. Some of them as low as 0.
Now, you've lived with this, Mark, because your son has diabetes and has since he was a child. So what kinds of things have you had to do? What kinds of things have you had to learn about and become aware of so that he can live a successful life? And how has that impacted the rest of the family who doesn't have this problem? You're a chef.
I'm a chef, and I love desserts. It's been a ride, and it's been an interesting ride, and I believe my son has really matured through this, and he looks as this is not so much a problem, but as a bit of a challenge in his life. But if you were to see Matthew, he's tall, he's slim, he likes to do lacrosse, he works out, and he monitors his blood sugars regularly and looks after himself. And I would say he's probably healthier than the normal 15-year-old boy out there. We had to change our eating habits. I love French cuisine with a lot of butter and a lot of fat. And we basically eat healthy. We try not to eat many processed foods. I'm blessed with being a chef that I'm there every morning to make breakfast for the boys. So we'll have something like an omelette with a slice of whole wheat toast instead of cereal. I'm there most of the nights. So my wife is an excellent cook, but we take turns in cooking. So everything we basically put on that kitchen table is something that we've made ourselves. And I think that's one of the biggest problems we've got is everything is processed and everybody is in this environment where they want it now and it wants to be done quick.
Why are processed foods bad for you?
Basically because you don't know what is in there. They've got preservatives, they've got additives, and laden with corn syrup or laden with some kind of salt.
And when you say processed foods, give me some examples of what you would consider a processed food.
To me, Mike, basically anything that comes in a cardboard box is being processed.
So those frozen dinners in the freezer case, processed.
Yeah.
Lunch meat?
Yeah.
Processed.
Yeah.
So anything that's not in the frozen section, like the meat section, the meat counter.
You know, when you're looking at meat, try to buy it fresh and try to buy it organic. But when you're looking at fruits and vegetables, you know, look at all them different colors, the varieties that you've got, all them different flavors. But everybody's so used to just eating carrots or potatoes or broccoli. Mm-hmm. We've got a whole host of vegetables. When you walk into that supermarket, everything is fresh. And I would rather be buying something that appeals to the eye and something that smells fresh than something that's wrapped in plastic.
But the reality for many people is that we do need to get packaged foods. We need to be able to make something quickly because there's no time. And if you go to a restaurant, you're dealing with the same issues. We don't know what they're putting in. Salt is one of the big offenders. A high volume of salt goes in the food, which then creates cravings for sugar.
Do packaged – and I only have 10 seconds. Do packaged or processed foods have to be unhealthy?
No.
No.
Not at all. And in fact, when we come back, let's talk a little bit about how you can look at a packaged food and find your way through it.
Okay. We'll do that with Peter Reinhart and Mark Allison, both with Johnson & Wales University. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Signature Healthcare, a concierge medical practice serving the Charlotte region since 2003, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, individualized attention, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org. And Harris Holt Framing and Art Services on Kenilworth Avenue in Dilworth, serving Charlotte for more than 20 years with custom picture framing, art installation, prints, and now wide format printing services. Details at HarrisHolt.com. It's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, the national hour, the November jobs numbers report, what's new in the fiscal cliff negotiations, and former President George W. Bush weighs in on immigration. That's at 10, the international hour at 11. By the way, if you love food, you can get your fill on our food blog, WFA Eats. Today, Tamara Wilson reflects on a Depression-era family cookbook that offers a peek back in time. Read about it and see pictures of it at WFAEats.org.
Ever wonder why that sauce never thickened or how to properly send back a bottle of wine? It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table. Now, every single week, we open up the lines to your calls. And frankly, it's my favorite part of the show. And believe me, anything goes. Join us. That's The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Hope you'll tune in that Saturday at 3 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in our Spirit Square studio with Peter Reinhardt, chef on assignment from Johnson & Wales, author of a new cookbook called The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking. Also with us, Mark Allison, the Dean of Culinary Education at the school. We were talking about processed foods and how they're bad for you and why they're bad for you. And I asked the question, are there any processed foods that can be good for you? Can you make a processed food that can be healthy? And you're going to talk to us about how you can spot them.
Well, one of the movements now in culinary education and in consumer education is to encourage people to look at the labels on the boxes of foods that you buy. So in every box now, the big breakthrough 20 years ago was getting the nutritional information on there, and it does list the sodium and it does list the carbohydrates and the sugars and the net carbs. And net carbs are very important. It's a very important number, because what that is the amount of carbohydrates in a portion minus the fiber, the dietary fiber, which is a good thing. So that lowers the carbs. Fiber allows your body to process those carbs in a more gradual manner, so it doesn't spike your blood sugar. So fiber is a very important part of our diet. So looking at the amount of fiber and then the net carbs is an important figure, almost as important as the calories and the sugars. So if you look at these things, you can actually regulate what you eat. You look at your sodium counts, and everybody has different dietary plans, and we don't promote, for instance, in our book, one particular plan. We know that these recipes will work with any low-carbohydrate plan, such as South Beach or Atkins or the paleo plans that are so popular, because they're all based in low carbohydrates and high proteins. But also, there's other plans. There's Weight Watchers. There's, you know, Jenny Craig, all those things that have different ways of balancing your diet in a way that's right for you. And we always encourage people to get some medical advice on which plan is best for your body type.
But if you're listening to this and you've decided, okay, I'm going to wean myself from processed foods and I'm going to start making more things fresh at home, or if suddenly you find yourself with a gluten problem, or you have a child, or you yourself become diabetic, mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of starting to cook at home using fresh ingredients. You have to know what you can and cannot eat and what the ingredients are going to be and what substitute ingredients can be put in there that make it taste good and look good. Some of them are in this cookbook, but what about those who are not in this cookbook? What do you do? Is there a rule of thumb? Where do you begin?
If you're eating out, the first thing you really need to do is look over the menu and then ask the waitress or the chef what products are natural, what products are low in carbohydrates, how much sugar, salt is added. Mm-hmm. And take it from there. It's a learning curve for everybody. And for me and my family, it's basically taken the last 14 years to learn this. So for anybody becoming a diabetic or a type 2 diabetic, it's a big learning curve, and they should have a conversation with their doctor.
If you eat in a chef-driven restaurant, I would think your chances of getting an answer to what you can eat or even have something
exactly
custom made for you,
yeah,
and your dietary needs is going to be something that's possible. But if you eat in a chain restaurant, are they preparing things from scratch back there in the kitchen, or are they getting things off the shelf that was shipped in because that's the name of the chain and it's going to be the same everywhere you go?
Unfortunately, a lot of the chain restaurants, it's either coming out the freezer or it's coming out of a box and you just warm it up and then serve it to your customer.
But fortunately, there is a movement even within the chain restaurants, because I just came from a meeting with a very large chain restaurant, 850 units around the country, and they're all beginning to look at, number one, gluten-free aspects of the menu. And actually, if you go to a place like P.F. Chang, which is an industry leader in actually saying, we are creating a gluten-free section of the menu. there are also many restaurants have already done the heart healthy, you know, symbols and all that. What they will do is customize. If you ask your server, you tell them what your situation is, ask if this, if the kitchen can identify things on the menu or prepare something for you that meets your specific dietary needs.
If
they
big,
will.
If big restaurants are feeling the need to do this to respond to customer needs, why isn't the food industry as a whole demanding that we go back to the kind of wheat that doesn't exacerbate this problem? I mean, it just seems to be a no-brainer to me.
That is a, that's a great topic for a whole show because we're really touching into the political dimension now. And so somebody who sort of understands what we what you just asked would say, it's a no-brainer. Why aren't we dealing with it? And then you talk to people in the industry and they go, well, there's a lot of things you don't understand.
Okay.
And some of that may be the amount of money that's going into the government, you know, from these large companies to want to control those devices. And they have rationales. There's, I always feel like there's no bad people out there. It's not like these people are evil and these people are good. But that's how sometimes the debate is framed.
Wow.
And it gets very emotional. I've been at conferences where people in the audience start breaking down and crying and they grab the mic and they start screaming at the panelists because it's such a touchy subject.
Yeah.
They just don't understand why aren't you caring about us? And they think they are.
Now, you brought food this morning. And as I walked into the studio here at Spirit Square today, I was welcomed by a glorious smell. And I think that comes from something you brought, Mark Allison.
Thank you, Mike. This is one of my creations. It's a Thai shrimp salad, and it's got cantaloupe melanin. It's got shrimp, cilantro, parsley. It's got fish sauce in, lime juice, lime zest. And it's just basically made the day before, so you can infuse all of them flavors together and then add the shrimp. Sometimes we'll add nuts, sometimes we don't, depending on we've got somebody coming over to the house that's got a nut allergy. But it's one of these dishes that everything is fresh, but it's been seasoned basically by herbs and spices.
And not sugar.
There's no sugar in there and there's no salt.
Why would you put sugar excuse me, in this to begin with? Suddenly I'm stricken.
You haven't even tasted it yet. And, the aromas are just choking you up. You wouldn't need to put a sugar in this one because melon is one of the key ingredients.
Right.
So it's already naturally sweet. There is sugar in there in a natural form.
Exactly. Yeah.
But, and so you don't want to boost that sugar as you might in a packaged version of this.
Exactly.
But, and then the salt, of course, is provided some of it from the fish sauce, which has, again, some natural saltiness.
It's fermented.
And it's fermented. Yeah, so there's a lot of flavor already inherent in all the ingredients. Got some buzz to it, too. It's a little spiciness, but it's almost like a melon ceviche, I think.
Exactly.
It's delicious.
Yeah. That is delicious.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it, Mike.
And I would not even have thought that you would need to put sugar in it, but it does. It tastes somewhat sweet.
Yes, it does.
On the front.
That's right, with the fruit and the lime zest.
That is amazingly good.
And you know what? I came up with that dish about 4 years ago, and I haven't heard one person that dislikes that dish yet.
Is this something that your son can eat without it affecting his blood sugar?
Actually, my son has made that numerous times. He's a
but he likes it. Huh?
Bit of a wizard in the kitchen, and that's one of his favorite dishes.
What makes it interesting is because it's interesting, and there's so many different flavors.
That's right.
And you taste them at different times.
Exactly,
it's like wine.
Yeah, it matures over time. You could keep that for at least 3 or 4 or 5 days.
Even with the shrimp in it?
I would leave the shrimp out if you're going to make that well in advance because the acid in the lime zest and the juice will break down the protein in the shrimp.
Yeah.
But you could make the base of that and then just add the shrimp.
But it starts sweet and then it becomes savory and then the hot spices kick in. And at the very end, I tasted something else.
You've touched into a culinary principle that I think every chef strives for, which is this multidimensionality of flavor.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that in the past. You go to the great restaurants deliver that beyond
that experience.
That one-dimensional sort of flavor hit and it's gone.
I got to tell you, that may be the best thing I've ever eaten.
Oh, thank you, Mike. I'll give you the recipe.
Please. It's wonderful.
That's fantastic.
And then you brought...
Here's a little dessert for you now after that. Yeah.
You brought some pecan sandies, for which, by the way, we have the recipe on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Very easy to make.
Are these in the book?
These are in the book. They're super easy to make and probably one of the most popular recipes from the book because a sandy is a cookie that crumbles when you bite into it.
Yeah.
And usually what makes it crumble is the sugar.
Yep.
And, of course, what we're using here in this particular version is we're using Splenda to replace the sugar, although I use also stevia. Liquid stevia is another way of going with that. But in this version, because yesterday I did a demonstration on television for this and made the batter, and then I already had some cookies. So I brought the batter home, baked them off, and brought them in for their show today. And so what you're getting is a lot of pecan flavor. It's like two parts pecan, one part almond flour. The only people that can't eat these cookies are people that have nut allergies. And unfortunately, that's the one demographic we had to leave out, because all of this is based on the idea of nut flours being better for you than starch flours.
Now this, you would never know that this was sugar-free.
That's right.
You would never know that. I guess it's flour-free, right?
Flour-free.
It is. The texture of it is, it's crumbly, but it has something to bite into.
Right.
And it's the flavors that you want in a pecan sandy. I mean, it's really, really
I actually now way prefer it to a regular standard pecan sandy. We have a recipe, for instance, for biscotti in the book that is better, in my opinion, than a regular traditional Italian biscotti. And it has that same principle. It has this sort of hardness, and then when you bite into it, it crumbles into your mouth. And then it kind of
dissolves.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so you get – and then because of the nut flours, just as Mark's dish had this long finish and a lot of flavors coming up later, because of the nut flours, you do get this depth in flavor that you taste for many, many minutes after you eat the actual product.
Both of these are incredibly satisfying. And are all the recipes in this book like that? In other words, I would not know and would not miss having regular, traditional baked goods if they all tasted like that sandy. Do they all taste like that?
They all taste that good. The whole point is satisfying. That's why we call it the joy of gluten-free cooking, because we don't want people to feel deprived. It's not something that you're doing as a sacrificial thing. It's just another way of enjoying food that is also guilt-free and gives you...
So why don't we just do this? Why don't we just dispense with all the other nonsense and just cook like this?
Well,
I wish we could.
We're moving in that direction. You know, I mean, just think about it. 5 years ago, how many people even knew what gluten-free was? And how many people were thinking about glycemic loads and that kind of stuff? The public has been educated, and the issue has tipped over into a mainstream issue. So lots of progress is being made.
If you can do this and do this as successfully as these cookies and as that – I'm not sure what you call this.
We call it Thai melon shrimp.
Okay. Does this threaten – the wheat farmers out there who have genetically changed their crop and caused this gluten problem in the first place? I mean, if you can get along totally without them.
That's a good question. I don't think that bread is ever going to go away. Of course, we give bread recipes in the book also made with this method. But bread itself will never go away. There's also, 90% of the people in this country are not sensitive to wheat. Bread is intrinsically deeply satisfying. It's such an important part of our nature, bread. I always say bread's been around for 6,000 years. It's not going away.
Right.
But what we are trying to do is provide safe, healthy alternatives for people that struggle with it. The foreword to our book was written by Dr. Tom Schneider, who specializes in cases like Dr. Smith today earlier, with people who have dietary-related illnesses. And he says, you got to remember that there's no food that's bad or good per se, but there are some foods that might be very good for certain people, like fruit, but that could be poison to somebody else who has a high sensitivity to that. And so finding that right balance is important, and giving options is what we're trying to do.
Talk to me about the caloric component of both of these examples that you've brought today. Are they low in calories? Obviously low in fat. Are they?
Why don't we start with Mark's?
In the shrimp, it's low calorie and very low fat, because the only fat really in there is off the shrimp, which has got very lean fat in it. It's basically a protein item.
And now in mine, it's just the opposite. The calories are about the same as you would get in a regular cookie, because the fat content it's rich. Nuts are not low in calorie per se. They're not high in calorie, but they're not low. And those calories mostly come from fats. There's some butter in these cookies that you just tasted. But what there isn't is carbs. And as Dr. Smith was saying earlier today, what happens is that your body, when it breaks down sugars, the excess calories that you don't need get stored in your body as fat. But fats, interestingly and ironically enough, can get burned up without the use of insulin. And so they don't get stored. Those get burned up actually faster than the carb calories get burned up, but the excess gets stored. Fat calories will actually become long-term fuel and won't be stored as fat. So what we find is that while this is not a low-calorie product, it's not a product that will actually add weight to you if you're eating, generally in this healthy way.
Now, Kathy on Facebook writes, so many breads, even gluten-free, use yeast. I am allergic. I'm wondering if Chef Reinhardt has any recipes in his new book that are for bread without gluten or yeast.
All of the breads in the book are yeast-free, and there's a very practical reason for that in addition to the sensitivity that many people who have sensitivities to one product are sensitive to others, and yeast is showing up a lot for people. These breads won't rise if you put yeast in them because they don't have the carbs that the yeast need to feed on to make the carbon dioxide. So we call these quick breads. They're risen with baking powder generally, which causes the bread to rise not as much as a yeast bread will rise. It doesn't have the gluten, so we use a little bit of xanthan gum in the bread recipes to help replace the gluten, which gives it a stretchability. But the whole structure will not be as big, but I can tell you they're very satisfying. We have a recipe for toasting bread that's made with half flaxseed flour and half pecan flour. And these flours are very easy to make at home with a little seed grinder. And I'm telling you, a couple slices of that fill you up and make you feel very satisfied.
It's part of the problem here that a lot of the flours that you're using are being made now from nuts. And if you have a nut allergy, you can't.
This book won't work for people with nut allergies, unfortunately. We had to leave that one group.
We have like 40 seconds left. What are some of the things that if you wanted to go in this direction, you should have in your pantry?
Well, for these products, in my book, it would be nuts and seeds. Those are like your high-potency ingredients. Yep. And a few other things. Stevia is something for everyone to look into. On our website, if you just go to the gluten-free, sugar-free .com website, we give some other substitutions for sugars. And then from the diabetic side, I think Mark could speak to that.
I would say, for our point of view, is try and buy as much product as freshly purchased as you possibly can.
That's it?
That's it.
That's pretty simple.
That's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mark Allison, the Dean of Culinary Education at Johnson & Wales University, Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment, and the author of a brand new book, which is actually beautiful, and Pecan Sandy's recipe is on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks, but there are a lot more in the book, so you ought to get the book. It's called The Joy of Gluten-Free, Sugar-Free Baking, and Dr. Michael Smith earlier today. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.